The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Afternoon. You're joining We the People Radio with Aaron Ryan.
Bill Pendiff.
And our producer, Bob Martin, who's pushing a lot of buttons over there and has been rendered mute.
Oh, he's a button-pushing fool right now. Let him go.
We've been, it's like, call this person, no. Call that person, no. We're switching.
Hut.
It's that kind of morning, afternoon. Feels like morning. It's the first thing we've done official today. So,
speak for yourself.
Well, I know. The ambassador's been on stage somewhere.
I've been planning the show, and I've been busy.
It's Sunday. God knows you're lying.
Oh, okay.
You're in trouble. Oh, my gosh. So, in all the insanity, we are being joined by Ambassador Francis Rooney this morning. He has an article that is actually in The Hill, and I'm sure it appeared elsewhere, but I listed the one from The Hill. It's ISIS, Islamic Extremism and the Long War. And, geez Louise, I mean, that has been all over the news, if you could get past Baltimore, actually.
And you've got that on the website.
And that is on the website.
It's a great article. I just read it last night, and I got a ton of questions.
Well, that's good. So you can find that online at wethepeopleradio.us, which is where you'll find all the information on our guests and archives and all that good stuff. And there is also a button there at the top of the page where we are chatting and streaming live here this hour. So, without further ado, Ambassador Rooney, where were you speaking today?
I'm speaking from Florida Gulf Coast University. I just did a graduation speech, and I'm going to do another one at 5 o'clock.
Oh, that's it. I was like, wow, you have to do some kind of speaking on Sunday. That figures graduation. I forgot. Oh, my gosh. So, so much for retirement. You've...
Sure. Yeah, it doesn't sound like a lot of retirement to me.
A little pipe dream for you?
Yeah, there's plenty going on with me. How about you all?
It's a good time, I guess, to be in radio. There's no shortage of topic.
No, and the world, as I just told those kids, the same thing you were just talking about. The world's a turbulent place with unprecedented challenges, many of which relate to this Middle Eastern stuff, many of it relates to globalization and in some ways, it's challenging, but in some ways, a fascinating time to be a college graduate.
Yeah, I guess so. It's like, where are you going to fit in, and what's it going to look like once you get there? I think, what kinds of things do they ask you?
Well, the good thing about giving your graduation speech is they don't get to ask you anything.
Right, but I mean, don't they, like, chase you down afterwards?
Oh, yeah, they do that. And they're mostly just thankful. Thankful to have the talk, and you know, they're very appreciative, they're very excited to get to meet a few of the families. It's graduation speeches are upbeat moments because you've got all these families there seeing their children. This is a school where about half or a third of the kids are first generation college attendees.
Oh, wow!
So there's a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of families, and it's really heartwarming to see.
That's kind of great because those guys have the potential to actually fix this mess. I'm sure that was part
exactly.
of your message.
You bet. They're the change agents. I always like to close with that quote from Theodore Roosevelt about dare, far better it is to dare mighty things and win glorious triumphs rather than take rank with those poor souls who neither suffer much nor enjoy much.
That
amen.
Is, yeah, it's like, what do you say after that? Yeah, amen. Good one.
One of the things you stated in your article, you had one line in there that really kind of grabbed me. It said, not since the communist state of Stalin or perhaps the Third Reich have we faced such a potential or at least self-proclaimed existential threat to the modern world. And, boy, that really says a lot and really hits home, doesn't it?
Well, it does to me. That's why I wrote the article. I'm just getting kind of tired of the president and a lot of liberals talking about this organized hegemonic terror by ISIS and unorganized hegemonic terror by Al-Qaeda, like describing it as some kind of series of random criminal acts. this is a, to me, it is a warlike condition that, that requires a warlike response from the world. And it involves soft diplomacy, it involves containment, it involves military action by, certainly by the people who have a better chance of success than we have had. And you deploy all tools of statecraft to try to interdict it and ultimately undermine it.
Well, I think if you look at where ISIS was a year ago compared to where they are today, I think it's pretty easy to say we're not winning that battle, are we?
I'm not sure we are winning it, and I'm not sure we even know how bad we may be losing it, because I don't think we know how this recruitment and radicalization process is working. You know, we keep hearing instances of Americans even becoming radicalized of all socioeconomic strata, not just people in prison and the marginalized poor, becoming radicalized and enthused by these terrorists to go fight against the United States in Syria and Iraq and many more from the UK, in fact.
Well, have we ever had this in our past where American citizens are leaving our country to join a foreign power like this? I mean, did that even happen? I guess it happened during World War II, but
they weren't planning
on coming back. And well, yeah, that.
Okay, except for Jane Fonda.
But it's really kind of a phenomenon, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't think it's ever happened other than, like you say, the few that there were anti-war protesters in the Vietnam War, but they didn't leave the country. They just stayed right here and had
right.
their sit-ins. And you might have had a few Japanese or Germans that became counterintelligence agents for their respective countries. I don't know. But this is, to me, unprecedented. And I think it's unprecedented that the administration has refused to call these guys enemy combatants, raise the definition of the conflict to the level of a war, as President Bush tried to do, therefore apply the international law norms of warlike conduct, not random criminal activity. These guys that go over there and fight certainly don't deserve Fourth Amendment rights. They don't deserve any rights that any other foreigner deserves that's fighting the United States.
Well, no. When you leave the country and join a foreign power, I think officially or unofficially, you have pretty much given up your citizenship, and you're going to have to go by the rules of war at that point.
But even the guys that aren't citizens, they're giving them access to constitutional privileges that obviously they don't deserve.
And I think that's maybe even worse.
Well, again, if it's a war, then I think enemy combatant rules apply. Things like Guantanamo and other containment and internment facilities have more legitimacy.
Absolutely. You talked about in your article, and I thought it was really interesting, how you said we have to work with the moderate Muslims and give them a seat at the table as far as negotiating with these guys over there, because they're not going to listen to the United States if there's not Muslims speaking on our behalf. And did I get that right?
Yeah, I kind of make the argument that, like, if you look at it like Pavlov's hierarchy of needs, you know, a secular state has, you know, standard of righteousness and principles in its foreign policy. A non-secular sovereign like the Holy See or the UN sometimes has an even different level of respect and for its positions because it's not a secular threat. And then when you have a religion that can unite, or religions that can unite, and try to discuss how another religion, the Muslim one, should operate, I think they have more inherent credibility than a state. And then ultimately, at the end of the day, I think you've got to have the vast majority of Muslims who are secular and decent people and are not radicalized become enthused to oppose the hijacking of their religion, the mutation of their doctrine, into a radicalized criminal situation.
And that part is always the part that catches me. It's like, how did these guys just sit by and watch it? And basically they're marginalized because of it. I don't know. You'd think they would step up with some sort of force.
Well, in a lot of cases, they're not even willing to fight. They want somebody else to do it.
Well, there's a...
See, I think both on both fronts, on both the ideological public opinion front as well as on the boots on the ground front. We have been appeasement-oriented, and we have been willing to do their fighting for them. I think two of the points of Pope Benedict's Regensburg speech and that Pope Francis has been saying recently are still very important, that the Muslims need to take responsibility for their religion, and they need to figure out how to draw it into consensus with the modern world. That the modern world is not going to return to 10th century behavior. They have to take the 10th century language out of their Quran or ignore it and focus on the parts of the Quran that are more, apostolic or religious oriented, pastoral.
How likely is that to happen on a scale of 1 to 10?
Well, okay, what if the United States, if we weren't quite willing so bend over backwards to accommodate Muslims and not want to hurt anybody's feelings to the point where we'll do school field trips to mosques but not synagogues or churches? I think maybe we just ought to treat Muslims like everybody else, and therefore when their behavior is not good, we should call them out, and when their behavior is good, we should be thankful for it. There are some institutions in this country that have reportedly, and I think it's true, been infiltrated or at least under the influence of some bad Muslim groups like Muslim Brotherhood. And I think those should be called out. One particular one is CARE, the Council for American Islamic Relations. And then the other thing we should focus on is imams in the United States and the people that go listen to them. Pew Research put out some statistics that 85% of imams in the United States are foreign-born. A little scary, and that 26% of those have openly opposed the United States way of life. It's been printed in the Wall Street Journal. And so to me, I say, wow, that's very dangerous for young people to be exposed to that many potentially radicalizing imams. So free speech would say the imam's free to say what he wants, but wartime surveillance would say the FBI should really know who's listening to them and pay close attention to where they're moving around.
Yeah, we ought to take them at their word. We've got to take a really quick break here. We will be back in 2 minutes. We are being joined by Ambassador Rooney. He's taking a little break between college graduation speeches and joining us on the topic of Islamic extremism, which we can't discuss enough. We're here at We the People Radio. Join us online, please. WeThePeopleRadio.us.
Too many questions,
too little time. Welcome back to We the People Radio. Thought we'd throw in a little,
levity.
John Travolta. you can't think about it without seeing the John Travolta dance.
And the white pants.
Yeah, not good. Those people in college that the ambassador was talking to, they have no idea why we're even laughing. Good for them. Join us online at WeThePeopleRadio.us. We're back with Ambassador Rooney. And we have a caller on the line. We have David, who has a quick question for you. We know your time is limited, Mr. Ambassador, so we will keep her short. David?
Yeah. Greetings from San Francisco. You know, I wanted to ask you if you were familiar with the origins of ISIS as it ties to the mineral companies, the oil companies, and Saudi Prince Bandar.
Not specifically ISIS, but I know that several of the Saudi princes have been involved in funding al-Qaeda, from which ISIS seems to have sprung. And they even founded, some of Osama bin Laden's people. It's a problem for me that Saudi Arabia in particular has been willing to help bad people and export Wahhabism around the world in order to keep peace at home. It's almost like a Faustian bargain. And I think that's come home to roost now. On the other hand, it's good to at least see that Saudi Arabia is finally starting to speak up and oppose terrorism and even try to marshal some fighting forces and airplanes in Yemen and in Iraq.
Well, thanks for that question, David. Hey, one question I had on what we were talking about earlier was, how do we get the trust of the American public with, you know, like right now we have some Muslims that are in our administration, and you hear a little bit about that, but
ties to the Muslim Brotherhood, not just, you know.
Well, that too. But if we're going to have a Muslim coalition speaking and trying to bring some sort of peace, how do we get the American public to trust the Muslims that are speaking on our behalf when they can lie, according to their Quran?
You know, I think Americans are the most trusting and decent people on earth. And what we've seen lately is maybe almost too much willingness to trust.
Oh, I agree.
Not enough willingness to look under the covers and say, what is Muslim American Foundation? What is CARE? What are what kind of military chaplains are they recommending that the military hire? What kind of, when they give support to some of these local demonstrations and things, what's their agenda? In this kind of dangerous world, I would argue that, like I say, if we're in a war, your paranoia level becomes heightened and you tend to look under the rocks a little closer.
Well, I doubt we ever finish this. I don't think this is a finish. I know it's not a word, but I don't think it's finishable.
I think it's going to take a long time, but ultimately everything seems to get resolved. And but I think it's going to take, it has a better chance of being resolved sooner when the countries around the radicalized areas become more engaged. When we are careful about our engagement and only become engaged in the areas where we can affect the outcome. And the entire Western world realizes that the ability for free movement of radicalized people or people who are susceptible to radicalization, going to countries where radical terrorism is taking place, is a bad thing. And then we can start to restrict people moving around these countries.
Well, it seems that, I mean, really, when you look around, you look at policies, you look at things that are happening here in the U.S., it's very anti-Christian. And this ISIS business and whoever they want to call themselves really feeds on that.
Yeah, they do. And what they have found is that the more heinous their criminality can be, and the broader it can be shown on YouTube and things like that, the more value they derive, both in using as a recruitment tool for people who are susceptible to radicalization, as well as a fear installation tool to further shock and paralyze the Western world. And I think, we might not be able to change the former, but we can certainly change the latter.
Sure. And what would you say to, you know, we have so many people that just get, you know, it reminds me of Vietnam again. You know, they just get screwed up about what side they're on and what's actually at stake. And, you know, they actually feel sorry for these guys.
Well, that's that appeasement I've kind of mentioned in earlier. I think that, and that's why it's great to see candid speaking like the Pope's. That's why I think the idea of recruiting other religious leaders to speak up would be a healthy idea. Same thing President Truman tried unsuccessfully in 1952. To have more voices speaking up, calling on Muslims in particular, but other scholars to criticize this kind of behavior and give some cover to say, an imam that's willing to step up.
And do you think the Pope's doing enough, our current Pope? Do you think he's being outspoken enough about it? Because now he's, like, launching off on something with global warming or something, climate change.
Yeah. If there's a problem with the Pope,
oh my gosh,
it's that he may fight too many fronted wars right now.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, I realize this isn't our topic, but, you know, the climate change thing bugged me. When I know he didn't actually speak out on it, but, you know, the part of his, I don't know what, you know, you would know what you call it, but his guys did, that they think climate change is real and all that. How much weight's that going to have?
Well, both Pope Benedict and now Pope Francis have spoken up to some degree about it, because I think they're kind of adopting the Eurocentric mentality that it's science is a foregone conclusion. When I'm not sure about that. I'm not a scientist, but I know a lot of smart people, scientists, that say it's some elements of the climate change debate are unproved. I mean, I don't think anybody would doubt that huge amounts of CO2 in the atmosphere is not necessarily a good thing, that pollution's not a good thing, and that finding cleaner energy as part of the overall energy solution is a useful endeavor. But that doesn't mean that we're going to impose radical growth impeding policies that take food off of people's plate to try to accomplish something that may not be justified.
Yeah, I keep hoping that Pope Francis will be drawn in, you know, taken away from it, actually. He'll be engaged by the fact that it's going to just create more poverty.
That's what I think they need to focus on, because they're advocating something which is inconsistent with the other part of the things they advocate.
Yeah, you can't be anti-poverty and then create policy that creates it. Tell me this, how engaged can the Pope be? I know that Pope John Paul was really, really, he was a big part of our Cold War, you know, the ending of our Cold War. How much of a deal can Pope Francis affect, do you think?
Well, we've seen him have a bit of an effect on this Cuba thing, right or wrong, whether you agree with it or not. He certainly was effective in using the convening power of the Holy See to bring the United States and Cuba together in a way that kept the press out of it long enough that they could achieve some sort of meeting of the minds. I'm a little skeptical as to whether this administration will make the kind of good deal that we need in Cuba to protect freedom, transparency, human rights, et cetera. But the principle of the Holy See's engagement, I think, is pretty dramatic. So it can have an effect. I think he's moved the needle a little bit on Islamic terrorism. I think Pope Benedict might have moved it more with his Regensburg speech, but they need to keep speaking up and encouraging other religious leaders to do it. Hopefully it'll get some traction.
Well, and as the ambassador, how much effect are you able to have? I realize it depends on the person and the Pope and, you know, the circumstance, but is it a place where you can weigh in?
Yeah. When I was over there, and I'm sure Ambassador Hackett's doing the same thing, we would meet with the Holy See people three or four times a week about different issues that the State Department would want to raise with them, or to get their feedback on things they wanted to raise with us. And that's kind of the routine diplomatic interchange. And I think that because certainly under George Bush, the alignment of fundamental personal principles was so strong with the Holy See's fundamental diplomatic principles, there was great willingness to kind of bend over backwards to listen to our message and to try to take positions that were aligned with our message. I don't know how much of that's been the case recently. You know, there's some divergence between the administration and the Holy See on many issues, even though they have seemed to have worked in alignment on this Cuba one.
Yeah, I wonder about that. You were there in a time when we were kind of all on the same page, really.
Yeah, that's right.
Very, very different. Do they ever call you up and see what you think, or are you just a retired guy that was already there?
No, I talked to them a lot, and especially in writing the book. I made a lot of trips there and spent a great deal of time with Holy See officials in writing the book. And, they were very helpful in that regard, by the way.
Well, that's
they wanted to see the story told.
That's kind of great. So we know you have to go back and I don't know, probably travel to another spot for your next graduation speech. But any thoughts you'd leave people with?
Well, I think that the biggest thing that I would say, which was the idea of that article, is that we are in a war, and we have to look at the conflicts that we're facing from radical terrorists broadly. Just like President Uribe realized what he had on his hands with the FARC and took very radical measures to finally bring them to a point of debility where President Santos may actually be able to create conditions for peace. There's an analogy to what we need to do with the radicalized terrorists in what happened in Colombia.
We had a question in the chat. who now influences the direction of the Pope? Well, I think we know where he gets most of his direction, but are there people that have political influence over what he announces publicly?
Well, you know, the Pope and the Secretary of State organization operate in foreign policy much like the United States. I mean, he gets advice from the Secretary of State, who, by the way, is one of the truly smartest diplomats in the Holy See's diplomacy, Cardinal Parolin. Mm-hmm. And then they have Monsignors under them that are country experts, like our State Department desk officers are. And so he gets a wide range of information so that they can make decisions on the basis of different inputs and try to avoid too much unilateral action.
When you were speaking to them, when you getting information for writing the book, did you find that they had insight and information that wasn't generally public knowledge?
Oftentimes they do, and in fact, I put some examples in the book about that. They have this incredible information network of nuns, priests scattered around the world. And sometimes they'll know things that we don't know, or they'll see it from a perspective we don't see. There's a great story that I was told when Cardinal Casaroli, who was the Secretary of State, went to see President H.W. Bush, and they were looking at a map about the Lebanon War, and the Cardinal looked at a bridge that's shown on the map and said, that bridge was bombed a few days ago. And we apparently didn't know that, but he knew that because some nuns that lived near the bridge had reported back in through the Papal Nuncio that the bridge had been bombed out and they couldn't get to where they were trying to get.
And ISIS, and you mentioned it in your article, has made threats against Rome and
They're going to go take over Rome.
Yeah, they're going to go take
That's
it
right.
over. And I know the Vatican is probably very concerned about that, but what kind of steps can they actually take to basically defend themselves, or are they taking measures to defend themselves? Because, I mean, once they target them, they are usually going to follow through.
Well, they have a security operation. In fact, it's run by one of the former guys in the Italian security business. A security and intelligence operation, and they try to be as effective as they can. It's hard because this Pope's a very open Pope who, if you've seen him, gets out in the crowds and likes to mix
it
up. But so you just don't know what could happen, you know. But the ISIS threat is not single dimensional. It is not just we want to hurt the Pope. I think they're speaking metaphorically as we want to hurt the Western civilization. And we want to hurt other religions. So I think when they attack your Rome, as they call it, I think they're speaking it on several levels, all of which require different levels of concerted action.
Oh, that's interesting. Because I read things like that, and I think, okay, they're going to send people to Rome and start bombing and attacking Rome directly. But, yeah, that's an interesting perspective.
Well, Ambassador? I guess we better let you go, otherwise you're going to be tardy. But we thank you, and I've relinked the book, The Global Vatican, on the website for today, and it's got a link on how to purchase it and all that stuff. And I think people would be let's steal you for one more minute. What's your elevator speech for the folks that aren't Catholic who would find this book interesting?
Well, the book's really not about being Catholic.
Well,
other than to point out some anti-Catholic prejudice, which certainly applies to many other religious and cultural subgroups within the United States in one form or fashion, one time or another. The book's about showing that the Holy See can be an effective force in doing good for principled foreign policy in the world and in helping diffuse conflicts and bring countries together, which is consistent with, our foreign policy view of spreading democracy and good principles and trying to oppose authoritarian governments and things like that. The other argument of the book is that given that the United States and the Holy See are the only two sovereign entities that are founded squarely on the natural rights of man, not on state government granted rights, and that they are the most foremost arbiters and defenders of free speech and freedom of religion, that, the Holy See and the United States are natural allies. And so for us to work together in a purely practical diplomatic sense, not religion, is a very important opportunity for our U.S. foreign policy.
And don't you think, with that being said, that is the reason they want to target Rome?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, look at the effect Benedict had from Regensburg. Many Muslim leaders have come out and criticized terrorists. Other countries have stepped up their criticizing of terrorism. And so these guys look at Rome metaphorically and physically as a force of opposition to their effort to create hegemonic control over this big parts of the Middle East.
Fabulous. Because, I know a lot of people, when they see Vatican, they think, oh, I'm not Catholic, I wouldn't be interested. But
really, probably more important.
Yeah, I think so, too. We really appreciate your time and your information and your perspective. Have a great day. Where's your next speech?
It's here at FGCU. It's the business school and the graduate school. So it starts here at about 4:30.
So now you're talking to the guys who've stayed longer and have a greater weight to do more good.
Well, Aaron and Bill, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for being with us. Sorry for all the on again, off again today, but we're really glad that we were able to work this out.
Yeah, let's do it again.
Okay, well, thank you much. Have a great day.
Thanks very much. All right. That was former Ambassador Francis Rooney calling us from Florida. We're now going to totally shift gears, except for we were kind of talking about evil. We're still going to do that. We're going to talk about the Philadelphia VA. Lots of things going on in Philadelphia. Yikes. And Kristen Rule, the I guess we'll call her the perennial whistleblower, because she's been in a bunch of different hearings. I met her last week back in Washington, and I've got her statement to the committee on the webpage for you and a bunch of other links. So please do utilize that. We'll be back with her in just a couple minutes. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
The Eastern world, it is exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
Bill, you look perplexed.
I'm a little perplexed there, yeah. I'm speechless.
Bob's music selection caught Bill in perplexed.
Yeah. What was that?
Bob's music selection has Bob perplexed, because I'm having to go to, shall we say, alternate sources. Since mine has, my usual source has apparently decided to crash today.
It's been that kind of day.
Who was that? Was that Devo, Men with Hats?
No, that was The Clash in Rock the Casbah.
Oh, The Clash. Yeah.
How did you not know that,
Bill?
That's
one genre I haven't kept up with.
Funny how that works.
It's past.
I guess that's kind of fitting, though.
Yeah, a little bit.
It is a little bit of a clash. We're going to talk about VA.
Yeah. You know, last night we went and saw the movie American Sniper, and... boy, what a great movie to start with, but it really gave you a great perspective on what our guys over there go through, and when they come back, the issues they have to deal with, both mentally and physically.
I think the most stunning part of the movie was the end, when the girl behind us said, oh, wow, he died?
He died, yeah. It's she was a little out of the loop on that.
Wow.
apparently
she... didn't know about the spoiler alert that was, all over the news forever. Yeah.
Very, very well done, though.
Alarming.
It really left you a lot more informed or a lot more, what's the word I'm looking for, caring about these guys that come back. And
I thought it was a pretty realistic portrayal,
well, the
actually.
Things that they have to deal with and the things that they have to see, I think, would mess anybody up. But anyway,
all the more reason for our Veterans Administration not to be screwed up.
Yeah, let's get on it and take care of these guys.
And as we know, the only people that are going to fix it really are the people who work there, because those guys know everything.
And
isn't
more.
That, isn't that right, Kristen?
Yes.
Yes, she says. So,
welcome.
Yeah, hi.
Thank you.
Yeah, we were like, hey, let's do quarter to one. Okay, let's do noon. No.
Yeah, we kind of.
Good thing you didn't have anything else to do today except wait for us to call and change the time on you. good grief. Hey, so.
I work at the VA. We must be flexible.
That's the rumor anyway. Hey, so tell people what you do there.
I'm an authorization quality review specialist, and that's just a fancy word for checking the quality of the benefit payments. So we make sure that the law is applied right and that the money that's going out is supposed to be correct, and my job is to check on those things.
See, we've done some programs. We haven't done a lot on the medical end yet. We're working our way up the food chain there. We've done a lot with the Benefits Administration as far as claims, because out here at our end, obviously from the hearing last week, you know, ours is about, you know, hiding claims and stuff. I think you guys are doing that there in Philly too, right?
We have a lot going on in Philly.
Yeah, and you have some of the same players that we have out here in Oakland. Your director, Diana Rubens, is the same lady who was the deputy undersecretary, and she came out to Oakland and found those 13,000 claims that Rusty Ann Brown reported to Congress last week. So it turns out she's your director. She got demoted to be your director, right? Or something?
I'm not sure. I don't know exactly how she ended up in Philly. That's right now, I guess, under investigation, as you've probably heard.
Except we know how much she got paid to go there. What was it, $300,000 or something? Oh, and ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to watch a really good, you know, you think, oh, congressional hearing, boring. No, not boring at all. On our page underneath Philadelphia and Oakland, it says systemic failures and mismanagement. That's dated April of this year. You seriously want to watch the beginning of the second link where they talk to Ms. Rubens about her moving expenses. Chairman Miller was kind of, let's see, what are we going to call it, feisty?
To say the least.
Yeah, he went berserk, which was, and rightfully so. Taxpayers shouldn't have to foot the bill for stuff like that. It was crazy. But you've been speaking out since, like, 2012, right?
Yes. I started actually reporting things in 2010, more internally than externally, though.
Okay.
And then I realized that the internal chain of command type stuff wasn't working, so I moved along to reaching out to the media, and I learned quickly that once you use that method, you tend to get some attention on the issue, and thankfully the New York Times had run a story, and then Congress became interested, and we've been really working together to try and make change in Philly, and hopefully throughout the whole country, because I don't think the problems in Philly are only in Philly. I believe they're probably at other offices as well.
See, that's really the kicker of it, is that these things are happening all over the place. So with your duplicate payments and your – give folks kind of an example of what that looks like.
The VA had moved to a new computer system to pay the benefit payments to the veterans and their survivors. And we noticed when we were working on the claims that some people were getting paid more than once per month. So we were trying to figure out why. And I guess the easy way to explain it is everybody who's getting a monetary payment from the VA is controlled by something called a PID number. So instead of using their social security number to control the payments, they use something else called a personal identification number. And unfortunately, one human being can have more than one of those, and the computer doesn't pick up that it's the same person. So even a simple misspelling of the name, or if one award is created in the system using someone's social security number and they use the exact same name, but forget to put the social security number on there when they put the claim under control, it'll create a duplicate award. And if that award gets authorized in order to pay a payment out, there's two players every time. There's someone who processes the case and someone who authorizes it. If the authorizer hits that button, it's possible then for the people to be paid twice per month. It's very hard to notice these payments. Obviously, the VA is having trouble finding them and picking up on it, and they definitely don't have a fix for it. So the system, recently, they've been very reactive, and they'll go back and stop the ones that are paying twice, but they don't have a solution to stop the problem from happening.
That's and you guys run, I mean, we've talked about this before. You run, I don't know, what, 10 different computer systems or something?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I've lost track of how many we use because things are always being substituted for an old one. Sometimes you have to use the old one and a new additional computer system, and everything has a different password. So it's a challenge. Just logging in takes about 10 minutes when you have to get into all these different systems and make sure that they're all working the right way.
That's unbelievable. And obviously, it's going to be super inefficient. You know, maximum inefficiency. How tough is it for people to, you know, when you have people who come in and start to work in your kind of job, I mean, how many of them just can't do it?
I think this is probably one of the hardest jobs I've ever had in my life because of everything you need to remember and how disorganized the system is. So there's a very high, at least at our office, a very high turnover rate. Part of my job is also to teach new employees coming in the job. We do a lot of training, and we are forever having new training classes because we might hire 40 people, but by the end of the training, sometimes close to half of them have left because they realize that this job's strenuous, it's very stressful, and the systems are not up to date. So every day you kind of feel like when you walk in the door that you don't know what's going to happen that day and what you're up for. And you hope that everything works out, but we're evaluating on a production system. So sometimes people don't want to deal with computer glitches, printers not working, fixing mistakes manually while being on a production system. It's very hard to meet all those expectations.
Sure, because to go and fix things and deal with that sort of thing, you might not, meet your quota of do you guys have the, are you guys on the points thing like we've heard about with Oakland before?
Yeah. Ever? Well, it's a national production system. Everybody's on that. So while we're hearing bad things that are going on in these offices, I'll always stand true to the point that I think we have a lot of bad managers in our office that are causing some of the problems, but I also think the production system breeds a lot of this corruption because if you don't get your points, you'll get fired. So when you have all these problems going on in the office or, you know, computer systems freezing or breaking down, they don't give you time as that part of the day that you weren't able to use the computer. You still have to get the same amount of work done. So if the system goes down for an hour, at least in our office, you have 8 hours to get X amount of points. And if for an hour you can't work on the computer system, they don't give you an hour blocked out of your average. You still have to do the same amount of work. They will usually they'll deny the time when the computer systems aren't working.
Oh, nice! So it incentivizes everybody basically to cheat because they have no choice. Hey, Kristen, we're gonna come back with you here. We've got 5 minutes of news break, and then when we come back, we're gonna send this second hour to air on your local station there at WNJC. So we'll have to do a tiny little recap of your. How you fit into the scheme of things, but then we just go on talking. We've got a whole hour. So, folks, stick with us. We have a second hour with Kristen Rule. We're going to be talking about the Philadelphia VA that obviously applies to other VAs around the country, give you a little insight into what's happening in the congressional hearings, and take your calls or questions if you've got them. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online at wethepeopleradio.us.